Welcome to The Roll Down. This podcast is for people of color who need a space to be known and seen, and guidance for those who are in the pursuit of justice. We are your hosts, Matthew Melendrez
and Alethea Lamberson. All right, y'all, we are in our second series. Thanks for joining us. Second series here on The Roll Down. And it's called In the Valley series. So Matthew and I, we are both people of faith. We believe in God and we look to the scriptures to guide us. And so in Psalm 23, it says, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me." We know that every person will be in a dark valley or valleys at some point, whether it be short or long, or even for some, our entire lives. So valleys can take the form of chronic illness, death, unfulfilled dreams, oppression, abuse, and many other things. So valleys are really a journey, and we want to talk about that in this series and what we feel are important topics that can be helpful for wherever you are in your valleys. Especially as we think about justice, there will be valleys that we will go through. And so we are excited, grateful for this time to be in the series In the Valley, and really excited for what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. And so our first episode was with Emma Tautolo, and she covered suffering and God. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, please go listen to that. It was raw and just really deep and good. And this episode will be focusing on lament and justice, and kind of looking ahead, we'll have episodes focused on rest, joy, and perseverance. And so we're really looking forward to the whole series. And this episode, we are privileged and honored to have Reverend Dr. Soonchan Ra. And he is someone who I first heard of about 10 years ago when I read one of his books, and it was one of the most impactful books I've ever read, one of my top five recommendations. And so it's just an honor that we have him here with us. So I'm going to read his bio for real quick, and we'll welcome him on. So Reverend Dr. Soonchan Ra is Milton B. Engelbreston Professor of Church Growth and Evangelism at North Park Theological Seminary. He is the author of The Next Evangelicalism, get it, Many Colors, Prophetic Lament, co-author of Forgive Us, Return to Justice, and Unsettling Truths. Soonchan received a BA from Columbia University, his MDiv from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, his Doctor of Theology from Harvard University, his DMin from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and his Doctor of Theology from Duke University. Ra formerly is the founding senior pastor of Cambridge Community Fellowship Church, a multi-ethnic church living out the values of racial reconciliation and social justice in the urban context. He has previously served on the board of World Vision, Sojourners, Christian Community Development Association. He has extensive experience in cross-cultural preaching as well as on numerous college campuses. Soonchan has been a main stage speaker at the Urbana Student Missions Conference, the Congress of Urban Ministry, the Urban Youth Workers Institute Conference, the CCDA National Conference, the Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary National Preaching Conference, the Fuller Missiology Conference, the Justice Conference, the Verge, Catalyst, and Kelvin Worship Conferences. Dr. Soonchan Ra, you are a man who is gifted and is experienced, and so we are so grateful that you're here. Welcome to The Roll Down.
Thank you so much for having me on. Remind me to give you the shorter bio next time. It's like three lines instead of, I think I might have missent my CV, my entire CV was just read.
Oh, so hey. Well, people got to know what's up.
Exactly. People need to know.
I appreciate that.
I just need to learn how to pronounce words better. So you're good.
You said my name right, which I thought would be the hardest thing to say, but that's pretty impressive. Oh.
We've had some practice.
But thank you so much for joining us. It has already been a very crazy, eventful year. How are you doing coming to this podcast?
Well, I mean, there's never been a last 12, 15 months like the last 12, 15 months, has there? Mm-hmm. I've been joking with folks that, you know, every century there are these catastrophic, major earth-shaking events that occur once a century. There's a pandemic, there's a, you know, market crash, there's a civil unrest, there's insurrection. You know, all these things happen once every 100 years, like, you know, 20, 30 years apart, because you have to recover before you get the next catastrophic event. But almost every catastrophic event you can think of happened in a 12-month time period. So I completely empathize, and I'm there with you, those who are just reeling emotionally, physically exhausted, emotionally worn out, spiritually kind of, you know, at the bottom of the barrel type of experience. I get that because that's where I am right now. On a positive note, though, I will say that to use kind of biblical language, I'm in the now and the not yet, the holy Saturday moment, because I got my first shot and I'm getting my second shot next week. So I'm in that in-between space of I've got my shot, but not quite yet. Can I get out there? I'm still in the tomb, but it's coming tomorrow. I'm going to get my shot and get out there. So I think it points to, we've had some tough times, and we need to acknowledge that. We need to think through that, pray through that, and reflect on those tough times. But at least for me, just thinking ahead, there's some redemptive times ahead as well. And so it's a combination of lament and sorrow, but also, is there some hope that's coming around the corner? I think there might be.
I think a lot of people can really feel, they resonate with what you just said. We have so many things that happen in the course of 15 months, and it just feels, and then weekly, just a lot of already big things that happen on the weekly, but they're overshadowed by the bigger things. So it's a lot to handle emotionally.
That's right.
So, well, this episode is focused on lament, and fortunately we have you who wrote a book called Prophetic Lament. And so just for our listeners who haven't had a chance to read it, but we just love to know, like, how did this book come about? What led you to write it? And kind of like, what was it like for you even looking at your own story as you wrote it?
Sure. Well, I've been an academic, and I've been teaching at a seminary grad school for the last 15 years, and that's really kind of defined my identity. But prior to that, I was in ministry for about the same amount, 15, 16 years. And so my career in terms of what I've been doing has been split evenly between ministry in the community as at a local church, along with my academic work. And the impetus for this particular book on lament actually goes back many, many years when I was a church planter as a minister and a pastor in the Cambridge-Boston area. And I had just been kind of finished my 5-year run as a campus minister at MIT and working with very top-notch, brilliant students at MIT, as well as at Harvard, Boston University, Wellesley, Tufts, Boston College. As you may know, Boston has no shortage of top-notch, you know, tier one schools. And so I really had a great experience working with that group. And so when we started the church back in 1996, I was trying to think about, all right, what's going to be what this group of people needed. And so I was drawing and, you know, reaching out to these college students, graduate students, again, graduates of MIT, graduates of Harvard. And this is a God thing, I think. And I was led to the Book of Lamentations. Mm. And that was the very first full sermon series that I did in my church plant. Now, those of you in the church world know that that would not have been what we call a seeker-sensitive, user-friendly mode of communication. You know, come to a church, 5 weeks of depression. You know, that was kind of the background of this. But, you know, God is pretty, not only has a sense of humor, but it's also very wise in how these things work. And I realized it was absolutely the most appropriate sermon series to start off a new church plant. Mm. And that was because, and this is very true, not only of Harvard and MIT, but just kind of brilliant college students across the United States. And I was working with some of the best. And what I saw with these brilliant college students is that they had never failed in anything. That's why they were at Harvard and MIT, right? I mean, they were the big fish in the little pond. They got the 4.0s. They got perfect scores in their SATs. They had never failed in anything. And that's why they were at these prestigious institutions. And so there was this underlying motif or narrative for many of them of triumphalism and exceptionalism. And in many cases, it was earned. They worked hard to get these grades. They worked hard to get into these schools. So this exceptionalism, triumphalism was kind of a part of their story. The problem, though, was our church was trying to do work in inner city neighborhood of Boston and Cambridge. We were trying to reach at-risk youth. We were trying to reach the poor in our community. We were trying to reach those who were disenfranchised, those who were victims of social and racial and economic injustice. And you can't come into that kind of setting with the arrogance of exceptionalism and triumphalism. Mm-hmm. And that's why lament and lamentation was an appropriate antidote, was a vaccination, so to speak, an appropriate inoculation in some sense to say, please don't come into these spaces where there is pain and suffering with your brand of exceptionalism and triumphalism. Mm. And so that turned out to be a very important theme for the church. How do we engage suffering in a way that is appropriate? And it was very important for us as a church, given our context. And then many, many years later, when I started writing on this, I was in a different context. I was a professor and no longer a pastor, but the same questions remained. How do a people who view themselves as exceptional, believing they're always going to win, actually encounter suffering and pain and respond appropriately? And that's actually how I define lament. Lament is the appropriate ecclesial, spiritual, liturgical response to the reality of pain and suffering and crisis that is in the world. And for my church back in 1996, we needed to acknowledge that reality. We were successful college students, graduates of Ivy League schools, et cetera, et cetera. But we were addressing and confronting pain and suffering in our world and our social reality. And we need to not respond to that with triumphalism and exceptionalism, but respond to that with lament and suffering alongside.
Wow. Just coming in hot right there. I just, oh, there's so much depth to everything you just said. And I think just hearing the we can't come in with the exceptionalism and triumphalism and having an appropriate response to suffering. And I just think, you know, I just have seen different moments where church leaders or ministry leaders go into different parts of the world that have a lot of physical needs or in refugee camps or many situations where you see the depth of power difference and that's why people are there. But them saying like, well, all that matters is sharing the gospel and a total just neglect of their physical reality. Mind you, these are probably pastors and church leaders who have a nice home and who fly back and go. And so I just love just like the call for an appropriate response to suffering as we go into different spaces or engage with different people. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Just the connection of, like, you're talking about playing a church, right? And you're like, yeah, this probably this doesn't fit in the church planning book. Like, start a series on Lamentations. But I also think it points to just the gap, right? Of like, we don't talk about this. And so the recognition. And, you know, as I was kind of flipping back through your book again, I wanted to even sit with you. You just gave a quick explanation of lament. And I wanted to read this because I feel like it just fits. But you say in the intro, laments are prayers of petition arising out of need, but lament is not simply the presentation of a list of complaints, nor merely the expression of sadness over difficult circumstances. And I think that's where, even what you're pointing out, you're at this planning this church and you're trying to reach at-risk youth and communities. And so it can simply be, oh, I'm just sad about the circumstances. And then we come in with our exceptionalism and triumphalism. Right. But then you talked about lament in the Bible is a liturgical response to the reality of suffering and engages God in the context of pain and trouble. The hope of lament is that God would respond to human suffering that is wholeheartedly communicated through lament. And so I think about the way you worded that and pointed that out, and then think about the context in which you were in at the time and how God led you to start with that and just meeting the students there and helping them see beyond themselves even and understand that, you know. And I think that applies to so many of us too, you know. Not maybe we didn't go to MIT or to Harvard or, you know, those prestigious schools, but we still can come into spaces with this exceptionalism and triumphalism because we think we just have all these things to offer all these people, you know? And so we miss so much of that. And so I just, appreciate what you notice and recognize and then how you led with that. And it wasn't the pretty thing to do, right? Like, we're playing a church, let's do the really fun, exciting thing. You're like, no, we're gonna walk through Lamentations. We're going to talk about lament and suffering. Like, wow, okay. But how that can so shape people. I think the significance of it. I wish I would have been shaped in that way as a young believer. And I wasn't. And feels like I'm backtracking almost of like, I've missed out on so much of understanding the depth of God's heart when it comes to suffering and missing lament in the midst of that.
Well, to me, that was one of the factors. As I've said, I was working with kind of a young church. These were college students or recent graduates. So this is, you know, 20 years ago, but they were in their 20s then. And so they were asking a different set of questions than your typical church attendee at that time, who would have been in their 40s then, 60s now. They would have been the boomers and the Gen Xers who were asking different questions. And these were more millennials and now Gen Y, Gen Z. And this idea of building these mega churches that are symbols of our capitalistic success, it just doesn't resonate. It's like, okay, you're a church with a lot of money and you're using all that money to put elevators and, you know, fountains and coffee shops and, you know, all these things that make yourself feel good and look good. But, you know, is that the meaning of the church? Is that the end goal of the church? And so I found the response, and we were in a rundown building in inner city Cambridge, and that didn't matter as much. You know, because we were in an inner city. I mean, those of you who've ever worked in urban context know that to try to keep a clean bathroom in an urban church is just an impossibility. But that's one of the first things they say about mega churches and church growth and attracting people to the church. Have the best bathrooms anywhere because people want to come to your church because you have good bathrooms. And you just can't do that in an urban, rundown inner city neighborhood. And so it's just this, again, the appropriate response. The city around us, the community around us was crying out for, well, they're crying out for justice. They were crying out for a people who cared for them, not only with compassion, but with a sense of justice for the people in the community as well. And Matt, you were kind of alluding to this. Compassion in some ways can be easy because you're still in power and in control. You're still benefiting out of showing compassion. You feel good about yourself. The challenging thing about justice, which lament pushes us towards, lament doesn't push us towards compassion. It pushes us towards justice. Lament calls us to recognize, okay, there is injustice. I might be even part of that injustice. And so if I bring compassion, it'll make me feel better, maybe even make the other person feel better. But if I bring justice, that's transformative of not only the individual who's a victim of injustice, but it's also transformative of me because I might have been a perpetrator of that injustice. So it's a very different formula when lament comes into the equation. It's not just let's feel bad for people and try to help them. Let's recognize that there is brokenness and let's address that brokenness, that injustice. And again, that might not be a compassionate response. It might be part of it, but it really will be a justice response.
Wow. So good. And I feel like that actually is a good segue into the next thing to continue talking about. And Matthew and I have heard you speak before, been, you know, around you in some different spaces, but you talk about in a lot of evangelical spaces, evangelicalism in the States in particular has an anemic understanding of lament. You know, as I was reading, you know, flipping through the book again, you talk about the loss of lament being a theological deficiency. And so I was wondering, if you can, having an anemic understanding of lament, can you share more about that? And then what would it look like to have a more robust understanding and theology of lament?
Well, lament, as I say this in the introduction, lament as a spiritual practice, especially as a liturgical practice, as a worship practice, is very absent. I give three examples. The first example is the kind of high church traditions, Anglican Church, Catholic Church, Episcopalian, etc., and how even when they are assigned the reading of lament or lament psalms, they skip it or they drop that lament psalm and replace it with a happier psalm. The other second study was on looking at hymns traditions, Baptist and Presbyterian hymnals. And that study showed that about 80 to 85% of the hymnal would be celebratory songs, and only about 15, 20% of the hymnal are hymns of suffering or lament songs. So you're seeing this disproportionate weighing towards celebration and running away from lament. As you may know, in the Bible, in the Psalms, which is reflects the worship life of Israel, you get 60% of the Psalms of celebration, and about 40% of the Psalms of lament. It's not quite 50-50, but clearly better, different from 80-20 or nothing at all. I looked at the evangelical tradition of contemporary worship. So you may know that if you sing a contemporary worship song, songs that have been written more recently that aren't in the hymnals, that aren't published in more of these kind of worship song formats, you are supposed to list your songs and licensed through CCLI, which is a international licensing company for contemporary worship songs. But in order for them to distribute the royalties, they actually have to keep a very accurate record of what songs are sung. So they actually have a top 100 list. And I went through and looked at every lyric of the top 100 most popular songs. Actually, honestly, it wasn't me. It was my TA. That's what TAs are for.
Yeah.
That's why you have TAs. I made my TA go through every single lyric of every single 100 popular most songs. And then I checked his work, of course.
Yeah.
But then noticed that of the top 100 most popular contemporary worship songs, 90 to 95 of them would be songs of celebration, and maybe 5, maybe 10 are songs of lament. Now, again, trace that back to the Psalms, 60-40. Trace that back to the hymnic traditions, 80-20. And now in the more contemporary worship, 90 to 95 to 5-10. So we are severely underrepresenting lament in our worship life. I also do this thing when I go to speak at conferences and I'm speaking on lament. I ask, you know, maybe 200 people, maybe 1,000 people. I ask them, raise your hands if you've ever heard an entire sermon series on the Book of Lamentations. And it's usually about 1%, 1 out of 100, 2 out of 200. You know, they're from the same church or it's a pastor and his wife or something like that. So you get a very small percentage who've actually heard teaching on lament or Lamentations. So what you see then is it's absent in our spiritual practices. And I think one of the evidences of this is the inability for many evangelicals right now to acknowledge brokenness and to acknowledge defeat. And you, I mean, you know, this is not a political statement. This is just a sociologist, social theologian myself, reflecting back on a political historical moment, where a particular party couldn't accept defeat, not because the facts lined up in any sort of way, not because any court cases were going their way, but simply because they couldn't accept defeat. They couldn't accept that they lost. And even the vaccination, the anti-vaxxing, it's like, look, you know, you're fighting a battle against a vaccine. You're losing. So take this medicine to stop you from losing, but there's still this resistance. You're losing this battle against this vaccine or against COVID. Wear a mask so that, you know, you can fight this battle well. And the response, and sadly, the largest number who resisted the mask and resisted meeting together, resisted the vaccine, and resisted that a certain president had lost the election, were actually white evangelicals because they're so steeped in the narrative of triumph and victory. And they've never had the discipline of addressing brokenness and loss that their instinctive response is to say, oh, we didn't lose. Oh, we're not in pain. Oh, we're not in suffering. Oh, we, you know, we're just going to go back to the way things were, make ourselves great again. We're not going to be replaced by people of color. We're going to rise up and reinstitute a Christian white nationalism. So the sense of not being able to deal with loss and brokenness and the reality of crisis and suffering in the world has really made white evangelicalism in particular, as they resist all these things, largely irrelevant. And it's actually speeding their demise rather than diminishing it, slowing it down.
I know y'all can't see us right now, but shook.
Majorly shook.
Oh, goodness. Wow. I love, Soon-Chan, the way you just talked about that, like the present reality, what it's steeped in.
Yeah.
Like, you know, our lack of historical understanding in this country, right, plays out. We see it over and over and over in our present day. But the way you just connected those dots of like, here's the current experience, it's because of this history, because of the lack of understanding. So if you've never paid attention or embraced defeat or loss, of course your response is going to be, no, we're going to triumph because we're exceptional.
Right.
And we're going to make things great again, or whatever mantra you decide to choose. And so,
That's tied into our really inadequate understanding of history. And again, we've seen this, sadly, in larger white evangelical circles, of the lack of understanding around a broken history in America. You know, slavery was not a good history. The genocide of natives was not a good history. The internment of Japanese American citizens is not a good history. The the treatment of children at the border, none of this is a good history. Now, we can bury our head in the sand and said, well, we did it because it helped make America great, right? We had to have free labor because that made our economy wonderful. We had to get rid of the Native Americans because that made our nation expand from coast to coast, from sea to shining sea. So there is this lack of understanding of how dysfunctional and how broken our history is because we cling to this triumphalism to say, oh, America is a great white Christian nation, and therefore we must have done nothing wrong. Well, that's absolutely not true. And that's why there's a lot of this resistance to actual truth in history. To say, we don't want to hear about the slave trade. We don't want to hear about, how natives were treated. We don't want to hear these things. And so it's removed from many of our history books, frankly. One of the most shocking moments I have is I teach a course called Journey to Mosaic at the seminary. It's my favorite class to teach. And we do a tour of Chicago, of racial history in Chicago. And so we go to the South Side to talk about gentrification. I'm sorry, West Side gentrification, South Side, the great migration of African Americans into the South Side. But one of the most significant moments is we have a time where we visit the Japanese American Center and we meet internment survivors from World War II. Chicago ended up being a destination for many internment survivors because they were taken away from the West Coast, moved to places like Arkansas, Colorado, in more inland. After the war, as they were being released, they didn't go back to California, many of them, because there was nothing there. Their businesses were taken away. Mm-hmm. Their houses were sold off. They had no money, no business. And, their neighbors kicked them out, all this bad stuff. So many of them ended up here in Chicago. About 20,000 Japanese Americans after the internment moved to Chicago. Wow. So it is a very rich history here. And so we get to meet some of these survivors. And they were teenagers, so they're in their 90s now, 80s and 90s. Wow. It's really amazing to hear their stories. And they talk about being kids and being rounded up and thrown into these boxcars. And we have pictures of, where they were driven to, where they were taken to in these trains. And it looks almost exactly like the Holocaust. Yeah. They're being shoved on the train with one suitcase, taken by train. They don't know where they're going in these boxcars. They pull up to this camp that looks like the concentration camps in World War II. And then they're dumped off there and they're living in these, one barracks with three or four families. Mm-hmm. This is their story that they tell. What I'm always stunned by is I at least half the class have never, ever heard this story before. How do you not hear this story?
Yeah.
How do you not know one of the most significant events in U.S. history, the internment and incarceration, the invalid incarceration, the unjust incarceration of American citizens? That was the other factor. These were U.S. citizens who were sent to jail without any due process by executive order and sent away into what was essentially concentration camps. So if you think about it in those terms, you have to say, why are we so deficient in our history? Because we're afraid to tell the truth. We're afraid to talk about the brokenness, and we don't lament because we don't know about this brokenness in our society.
Wow. That's, again, so much depth to everything you just shared. And I think one thing we've shared on this podcast before is something that I heard from Sandra one of the first times I saw her speak at an event. And one of the things she said was, theological formation begins at the moment of salvation. And that's just ringing through my ears right now. It's just like, when we talked about how for a lot of the 90s and early 2000 people who became a Christian, it was all about purity and not drinking and not cussing. And that was like what was emphasized in the moment. Literally, I had shared in other episodes right after I started following Christ. Literally the next day, it went into, as a camp, it went into a purity conference.
Right.
And so just the lack of formation of justice and lament and suffering. Yeah. And as you're sharing this, I'm just thinking, man, like how much that early theological formation, if it has that triumphalism, the exceptionalism, the individualism, all that combined, how much violence that has led to. Like theological formation has led to so much violence and genocide in our country alone, not to mention different places in the world. But I would keep thinking about how much individualism as an undercurrent of those things you're mentioning just has created some of the most horrific things we've seen. And in current day, as people are trying to lament as generational trauma and the history is becoming more known, a lot of white evangelicalism saying, no, 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 you're not allowed to lament. You can't be crying about something that happened 400 years ago, 20 years ago, or even last week. And so I just appreciate just kind of that framework of understanding how important lament is for many parts of our lives.
Yes, and there's the richness of, I love the phrase, theological formation, which I think is another way of saying discipleship, healthy discipleship. And one of my favorite quotes is by an NYU sociologist, Richard Sennett. He says, without a disturbed sense of ourselves, why would any of us ever change? And so that's a secular condemnation of our discipleship, as far as I can tell, that our discipleship is, in a good way, moving towards good goals. You know, read your Bible every day, say your prayers, eat your vitamins, you know, work out. You know, these are the good things we're supposed to be moving towards in our discipleship. But what we don't do is actually have a disturbed sense of our social reality, a disturbed sense, and that's what lament is. Lament tells the truth to say, look, I appreciate you reading your Bible every day. I appreciate you going to Sunday service every day. I appreciate you doing all these good things. But there's also the sense of how we got here is not so pure and pristine and perfect. We've done a few things wrong here. Yes, the Puritans gave us some good theology, but they also gave us slave owners and normalized slave ownership. That's something we've got to deal with in terms of truth telling. Yes, America has a constitution that everybody raves about, but the constitution also has a few things in there that are not necessarily good for people of color, particularly African Americans, who are considered three-fifths human. The Declaration of Independence, yes, it talks about freedom and individual rights, but it also talks about merciless Indian savages. So there's a lot of stuff that we actually should say, yeah, this is good. It's good to read your Bible. It's good to say your prayers. It's good to take your vitamins. I'm spoofing on Hulk Hogan's WrestleMania here a little bit. But you get the idea. They're good things that we can do. But at the same time, we have to reflect back on a lot of the truth that actually makes us uncomfortable. Again, without a disturbed sense of ourselves, why would any of us want to grow or change? We need that disturbed sense of ourselves.
Yeah.
That's a profound statement, that quote. And it's so interesting, Soonchan, as you're just speaking, when I think about, so I'm about reading your Bibles, but then even then, what do we talk about? How we read our Bibles, right? And so, because I think about what you wrote in the book, the way you break down Lamentations, right? It's the, there's so much depth to it, right? But the, you know, the prophet Jeremiah, as most people assume, is a writer of Lamentations. The reflection, paying attention, seeing what's happening, the desolation that has come to the city, right? And and then just working through those five chapters of Lamentations. But I think about the disconnect even, and I'll own my for myself too, right? Of even how I've been taught to read my Bible, you know, as a as a young Christian, of just kind of read and what verses mean something to you and what ones make you feel good, but that's really lacking the historical context of the scriptures, which totally play into our disconnect in our U.S. history, right? Of let me just pay attention to things that make me feel really good. To what you just pointed out with the Constitution and the Declaration, like, yes, those things are good. I don't want to talk about the other stuff just the way I don't want to pay attention to all the mess, the slavery, the all the mess in the scriptures. I don't want to, I'm not going to pay attention to that stuff. What it really stands out, oh, this makes me feel really good. That's going to shape me. Therefore, then I live that out here again in the U.S. And so I just see the correlation to the two. Yes. So I appreciate even in the book how you break down Lamentations and the depth that is there. And again, it's so much of what we're missing in our discipleship.
Well, Lamentations, in terms of the authorship, is really interesting to me anyway. So as you pointed out, the traditional historical attribution of who wrote Lamentations is to the prophet Jeremiah. The reason we know this is that given the context, this is right after the exile, where they took the most learned, the prophets, priests, kings, anybody who could pretty much read or write, they took them away to Babylon. Because they didn't want Jerusalem to rebuild itself. So they left behind anybody, they said, mostly women, children, crippled, lame, blind, and the sick. But we do know that Jeremiah was one of the very few, if not the only literate person who was allowed to stay behind in Jerusalem. So he's oftentimes attributed the authorship of the Book of Lamentations. The problem is if you read through it and compare the writing style of Lamentations to the writing style of Jeremiah, the book we know he wrote, bears his name, the styles are just drastically different. It just doesn't make sense that the same person could write these two different books. The joke that I say is like, it's like reading Shakespeare and Kendrick Lamar. both are great writers, and only one of them has a Pulitzer, by the way. I just want to point that out. Shakespeare doesn't have a Pulitzer. Kendrick's got a Pulitzer.
Well,
but they're both great writers. They're probably not the same person because the style of writing is so different. Mm. And it's kind of similar to Jeremiah Lamentation. The style of writing is so different. What I point out is that, so here is this learned leader. You know, he's the person with the education, he's got the language skills, and he's very articulate, as the book of Jeremiah attests to. But what he does in the book of Lamentations is that we can assume that he wrote down the words as the only literate person left in Jerusalem, but he's really not writing down his words. That's why the style is so different. He's writing down the words of the people that have gathered at the city gate. We would call these the protesters in the 21st century. Mm. We would call these the mobs that are formed in our city streets. That's the group that gathers at the city gate, and they tell their stories of suffering. Mm. They cry out, and it's mostly women and children, the souls who have suffered the most. And so I don't understand why we want to silence the voices in the street right now, because those are the voices that Jeremiah actually... I say, Jeremiah just shuts his mouth and say, I don't have more to say. I really want to hear the voices of those that have suffered the most. Mm. In this case, the women, the children, the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. We've got to hear and elevate their voices.
Yeah.
And so Jeremiah steps out of the way. And this is controversial to say right now at this moment in history, especially in the U.S., I really don't want to hear from a white megachurch pastor tell me about race. That is the last thing I want to hear. You don't have anything to say about race right now because you're complicit in the silence over the last several decades on the issue of race. And please don't try to shut up the voices on the street, because these are the voices that come out loud and clear in the Book of Lamentations. And in fact, the leader, the educated, the prophet, Jeremiah, shuts his mouth so that the voices on the street can ring true and ring out. And that's, again, is a piece of the history that we're missing. We want the experts. We want the church, mega church leaders. We want the successful, pastors to speak on the behalf. No, I want to hear from those that have been hurt the most. I want to hear from George Floyd's family. I want to hear from the members of the community that lost many, many precious lives in the Atlanta shootings. Don't tell me what the police officer said about the shooter. I want to hear what the people in the community heard and what they said about the shooter and what happened to them. So there are these moments where the leaders need to shut their mouths and make the room for the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, and the blind to speak out.
Amen.
Amen. Yes. Yeah, I'm like, again, I just, if like every time you finish, I'm trying to process. I'm like, oh, I need to say something back. But I think as you're sharing this too, I think another thing that comes to mind, I think that just almost is, and this is something that Emma talks about, is that we have also a very anemic theology of Genesis 1 and 2. Mm. Like in our kind of culture, we start at Genesis 3, the fall, but we don't talk about how God intended things to be and how he created and intended, and how we're longing for the garden, and how much that relates to, like, that's pointing to something in us when we see something on a more global, national, you know, whether it's historical in the Bible, historical in the U.S., or current day with everything that we're seeing going on and the violence towards communities of color, there is that longing, like, this is not how it should be. Mm-hmm. And that's going up against a lot of the, especially in white evangelicalism, who are a lot of times the more powerful ones and platforms and financially, have a lot more finances. They're the ones leading the church, but they don't have those questions. They don't have that formation. Yeah. And so right now we see this, like, communities of color, those who are being marginalized, oppressed, we're trying to say, hey, like, let's cry out for justice. Let's weep together. And you see this throughout Weep With Those Who Weep, Lamentations, and this is not how it should be. And it just feels like we're reading two entire different scriptures.
Yeah.
And so just, can you speak to that? Like you, right now, today, there is a lot going on. It is weekly.
Yeah.
Something else happens, whether it be to the Asian American community, to the different trials that are happening, the violence and shootings and children at the cages and this cry for justice. How can you speak to today's climate and how justice and lament intersect?
Yeah, we've got to hear the voices of the others. We've got to hear the voices of those that are different, have different sets of experiences. I would say for me personally, that's been my most significant place of growth, both as a person, as a Christian, but also as an academic, that my academic work would not really do well if it weren't for the opportunity to hear from other voices. I was very blessed. We mentioned that I started a church when I was in my late 20s, and that's way too young to start a church. And so one of the things I did was I immediately sought out mentors. And I went to about 9 different African-American pastors in the city of Cambridge and Boston. And I said, look, I'm just this young, stupid kid trying to start a church in the city. I don't know what I'm doing. Can you mentor me? All of them said yes. 8 of them followed up in the most significant ways imaginable. Call me out of the blue. It's time for me to take you to lunch. Calls me out of the blue. I'm praying for you today. What can I pray for you about? Calls me out of the blue. You're going to come to my church Sunday. We as a church are going to bless you and pray for you. You know, these were things that would happen on a regular basis. Week after week, these African-American pastors would mentor me, pastor me, you know, and care for me. By the way, even after I left the church, they kept it up. My successor at the church, he says, yeah, they still call me once a week, check in on me. They still check in with me and, you know, tell me what's going on and, you know, pray. How can I pray for you and your family? So that those kinds of relationships, I don't know where my life would be without those kinds of profound relationships of hearing and learning and sitting at the feet of these African-American pastors. My first doctorate was with Eldon Villafañe and Humberto Alfaro. So my chance to connect with Latino scholars in the area of ministry. My second doctorate was with Willie Jennings, Jay Carter, Valerie Cooper, Emmanuel Katongole. These were African-American scholars, A.G. Miller. These were African-American scholars at Duke who really mentored me. And so these experiences have shaped who I am. And more recently, of course, my latest book is co-authored with a Native American activist, Mark Charles. My connection over the years with the Native American community, Richard Twiss, who's the late Richard Twiss, was a very dear friend and mentor of mine, Terry LeBlanc, Randy Woodley, Ray Aldrin, these are Andrea Smith. These are all individuals in the Native American community that have just blessed me beyond what I could measure. And so those are the places I say, how could I ever be where I want to be and who I want to be without these other stories in my life? And yet, and yes, they will challenge me, of course. They will say, you know, the first time I was in a panel discussion with Eugene Rivers, who's an African-American pastor in Boston, pretty dynamic, you know, very, very controversial person. and the first thing he says to me, he's kind of saying, where are you Koreans in the midst of all this issue around race? And then he goes to list all these examples of Korean shopkeepers that have shot Black patrons. And I'm kind of on my heels trying to say, okay, how do I respond to this as a Korean American on this panel with Eugene Rivers? But it was out of that kind of confrontation, out of that place of disagreement that we forged a very good friendship and relationship. And we partnered together in a number of different projects addressing at-risk youth and violence in Boston because I didn't, you know, walk away from that relationship because it was contentious at first. And so these are the spaces where can we learn from each other, even if there are some difficult conversations that have to be said and done at the very beginning of this process? And I think lament allows us to do that. Lament gives us a common space where one is not the person who has all the answers and, you know, gives the answers to somebody else. So a couple of spaces I would describe as dysfunctional ways of relating to others. One is the dysfunctional use of the word hospitality. I don't like the word hospitality because hospitality implies one is the host and the other is the guest. And the guest is not allowed to stay forever in the host home. The example I use is if you invite me to your house as a host and I'm your guest and you want to be a good host, you bring kimchi. and you buy it that day and you serve it at your table because you're trying to be a good host, a hospitable host. I thank you for it. But when I leave, what do you do with the kimchi? You get, you know, rubber gloves and tongs and you wrap it in several layers of garbage and you throw it out because you don't want that in your refrigerator. Trust me. Mm-hmm. But if I'm moving in with you, now the kimchi isn't there just for one day. Mm-hmm. It's now in your refrigerator and your yogurt is starting to taste like kimchi. Your milk and your coffee now is starting to taste like kimchi. That's not hospitality. We went beyond hospitality at that point. Yeah. And so the idea of hospitality is, as long as I'm the host, I like hospitality because I look good, I feel good, I'm doing all these good things for you, the guest. But that is not, first of all, it's not the biblical hospitality, but that's the way we usually think about hospitality. So that's a failure in our understanding of what a genuine family looks like. We live together and my food is going to smell like your food and your food is going to smell like my food. The other problematic one is the whole idea of a hand out versus a hand up. This was something I heard at a conference where a suburban white church pastor was saying, hey, we're not about a handout to the black community or inner city neighborhoods. That's not what suburban churches need to do. We don't give a handout. We give a hand up. And I began to think about this and said, you know, if it's a choice between a handout and a hand up, I don't want your hand up. I would take the handout because then I can walk away. Mm. But with a hand up, you're implying that you're in a superior position to me and you're going to bring me up, this lowly person, up to your level. That's what a hand up is saying to me. And that is paternalism. So if you're going to choose between hand up and hand out, just give me the handout. Then I can walk away and I don't have to deal with you. But I'm saying the in-between space is the hand across. Don't tell me that I'm lower than you and you need to bring me up to your level. Or don't tell me that I'm this little, you know, charity case that you're going to do a handout to. Reach a hand across and let's be partners in the gospel. Let's be partners in the church. And I think, again, lament is that common space because lament acknowledges the commonality of our brokenness. So even if you are the person that has created this oppressive environment as the perpetrator, in many ways, you're still a victim of that perpetration of violence. And so you don't come into lament saying, I can fix this. You can't. You caused the violence. You can't. You perpetuated that violence. So lament is both the suffering and even the perpetrator can meet in a common space for repentance and confession.
Oh my.
That's the power of lament.
And just like, I guess, especially when it relates to justice, like today, I just feel like, imagine if that was the common language.
Yes.
If that can bring, you know, there's so much division and so much, and there's beyond division. I don't know what some of the things that we're seeing to call it, but just if we had that common space, which means we need to have that theology of lament in order to even talk and to pray together, to kind of have something like almost like this third party, like we're so different and we're seeing things and experiencing things so different. But if this is what can bring us back together, that's just so powerful. And just what you said, the question, where would I be without these stories? And I'm asking myself that, not just in reflecting of who I'm grateful for, but even just recognizing how still anemic and deficient I am because there's stories I haven't brought into my life and there's stories that I haven't been able to be impacted by and changed by and transformed by. Yes. And so I just appreciate even you laying out the different moments in your story where you were able to collaborate, work under, and learn from different communities and how much that has shaped you, who you are today. And I think that's some of the things that a lot of us are scared of is as we allow these things to impact us, it changes us. We evolve.
That's right.
And sometimes we're scared, who am I going to become? Will others like who I'm becoming? Will my family, will my friends? And I think there's so much fear in that, but I think that there's also so much freedom and seeing God in a more fuller picture and experiencing others in a more fuller picture when we allow for that to happen. So just thank you so much for laying that out for us.
Yeah, the lament gives us a common space. It acknowledges the commonality of our brokenness. I think I'm going to sit with that for a little bit. That just... Yeah, it's very challenging to me, and it's expanding my understanding of lament and how it brings us together. Something you hit on, and I want to pull this from your book. This I was reading this like wide-eyed earlier, and I think it ties into some of what we're talking about, but talking about justice. And even just the hospitality thing you just mentioned. I want to read this and would love to hear your response to it too, but talking about justice and even the present day, right? There's so many things we're fighting for justice. It's like a hot topic. It's a buzzword. It's the thing you need to be doing, right? We need to talk about justice, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say this in the chapter, Persisting in Lament. The term justice is too casually thrown about without the corresponding sacrifice. We want the popularity associated with being justice activists, but we don't want to lament alongside those who suffer. Instead of a justice that arises from the lament of suffering, justice is misappropriated as a furtherance of the narrative of celebration. American Christian justice leaders are applauded for their self-sacrifice, which allows for a furtherance of Western exceptionalism and even exploitation of justice as a career-building move. The uplifting of privileged individuals who use justice to expand their own influence serves a narrative of triumphalism rather than engaging the narrative of lament. And yeah, if you could just speak that even a little bit too of kind of what we were just talking about, because things for us to be mindful of, right? We're talking about the part of our podcast. We want to give guidance for those from the pursuit of justice. We're talking about the intersection of lament and justice. What are things for us to be mindful of and aware of and cautious of even as we're continuing to think about engaging in justice work?
That's a great question. And I think I was writing that out of a place of surprise, of cynicism, which is oftentimes my automatic position when I'm upset about what's going on in the world. I kind of revert to cynicism. I do think that, as I think I kind of said this in some form earlier, relationships are critical to keeping justice in its particular and good and important space. And one of the things that I miss about the local church pastoring, and I haven't really pastored in a local church in a long time, is that I could live in the community and be part of the community and learn from those who are in these spaces. Now, you know, my background is that I grew up poor. I grew up in a single parent home in inner city Baltimore, rough neighborhood, redundant, rough neighborhood in Baltimore. That's pretty much a given. I grew up in a very racially diverse neighborhood, but all of us were on food stamps. All of us were in subsidized housing. It was kind of a rough upbringing. Now, we were on food stamps. We were on, you know, all of this stuff. And I'm very far from that right now. You know, I have multiple degrees from Ivy League schools. And so that reality is still a part of who I am, no question. It's part of my formation. It's part of what makes me who I am today because of my experience growing up in a poor neighborhood, in a neighborhood that was rife with injustice and racial strife. That's part of my social reality. But because I've come quite a distance from that, pastoring a church, you know, many years of education, you know, writing books, all of that has kind of removed me from that reality. That it's becoming harder and harder for me to feel that and not just think that. And so that's my call to say, if we're going to be advocates of justice, I think we should not only think it, and we should work hard, read the scriptures, understand our theology, not only think it, but also feel it. The Harvard Negotiating Group has this phenomenal book called Difficult Conversation. It talks about communicating on three levels: fact, feeling, and identity. The fact part, I think most of us got. We can read the books in justice. We can quote the scripture. We can give all the theological variations of justice. We do that well. We need to work on the feeling part of it as well. We need to feel the compassion. We need to feel the connection with those that are suffering. The third part is the hardest one, I think, which is our very identity has to be in places in solidarity and in connection with the broken and the suffering. Otherwise, if we're not communicating all three levels and maybe only communicating on that first level, then our justice is cerebral and our justice might make us look good and sound good. But at the end of the day, is it the true full communication of justice? You know, I'll say this, in all my years of working in seminary and working with young people, especially as a seminary professor, I have never once thought you don't know enough to a seminary graduate. I have never once thought you need to take at least one more class before I let you graduate from seminary. Never happened. I think, you know, we do a good job of teaching content. I have often thought, and I'm not going to say how many, I have often thought, I don't think you have the heart for this. I don't think this is who you are and who you want to be. That's a tougher issue to deal with. So we can say a lot of people have the mind and intellectual capacity and the right ideology around justice. That's good. We don't want to discount that. But do you have the heart for it? Mm. And do you have the identity for it? That's a tougher call for many of us.
Wow. That's just so practical and tangible questions to run by. Mm-hmm. I think I'm thinking like what to check our motives. Like what are our motives when we're doing something, saying something, or speaking on something? And I just really appreciate that call to like really check our motives and our all three kind of aligning to like what's our motivation to fighting for justice? Is it to make ourselves look good, or is it truly for the liberation of other people? Amen. Do I want to look like a good ally, or do I actually want to see people free? Amen. And so I just appreciate that. It's so tangible. And I just thank you for, you know, when we talk about valleys and suffering, we've talked about there's various forms, you know, and we hit a lot on the historical kind of macro. And so as we close out this episode, a lot of people who are listening probably are going through a variety of types of valleys and suffering. Yeah. And so can you just speak to maybe some valleys you've walked through? Yeah. What did you learn? And just speak to those who are walking in those right now on a more personal level.
Yeah, and that's been a real part of my story. I I'm kind of in the now and the not yet stage where I can see the hope around the corner. But not just this past year, the last 4 years have been very challenging for me. But I'll hit on a couple of points. One was more than a year ago, about 13 months ago, two of my students died of COVID. They were among the earliest victims. They were students that I've been teaching at Stateville Correctional Center. North Park has this wonderful program where we do a master's degree and bachelor's degree program at Stateville Correctional. It's a max security prison right outside of the city of Chicago. It's about an hour away. It's where most Chicago residents end up if they're in a max security prison. It was devastating because these were my students. And it was in March. It was very early on in the process because the prisons were actually the first hit with COVID. And as you can imagine, in a situation like in prison, there's no social distancing, you know. And so it just kind of ran throughout the whole prison system. The correction officers, as well as the incarcerated, they were just, you know, run over by this. And again, two of my students died. One, he was 45 years old, Joseph Wilson. We called him Big Fella. One of the nicest human beings you're ever going to meet. He was in jail unjustly. He was about 19 years old. His two younger siblings found a gun on an empty lot in the west side of Chicago. They brought it to their big brother. And he said, "What are you doing with this? I'm taking it away from you." He took it away. He was about to throw it away or toss it when a white man pulls up in a late model luxury vehicle. And he says, "Hey, I'll buy that gun off of you." So he gives him the money and he takes the gun, whatever. "I don't need the gun. I'm going to throw it away anyway." A block later, the man shoots himself in the head. Big Fella was charged with homicide, murder in the first degree, for killing this guy. Now, all the forensic evidence clearly showed the powder burns, none on Big Fella, all on the hand. The gun is obvious on the inside. Didn't matter. This was a black man, you know, whose prints were on the gun. None of the facts matter. So he was in jail. The Innocence Project in Northwestern was picked up on this, and they were going to actually take it to a retrial. But he had already spent more than 20 years in jail. And I think the Innocence Project would have gotten him off because of all the forensic evidence that showed clearly, you know, there was no other evidence aside from the fingerprints. But before he could, he died. He died because of COVID. The devastation to our community, North Park and to Stateville, because Big Fella was one of our leaders. He was the guy who, you know, witnessed to every person that he met. He learned how to cut hair so he could offer free haircuts and then share the gospel with them while he was cutting their hair. And he died. And he died in isolation. He died in an IC unit. He could not say goodbye to in person to his wife and daughter. And this is where it's devastating. Yeah. And you know, it really took our community for a loop to know that not only because this was early on that the Big Fella had died, but that, you know, more could come, more deaths could occur. And I think last summer my mom passed away. My mom was in her 80s, And the stories that I often tell of my mom, is, and you know, she's one of the people I dedicate my book to. And many times over, I talk about my mom as the person that was our spiritual strength. You know, my dad left our family, and my mom was the single mom who raised the kids and worked two jobs every you know, 20 hours a day, 6 days a week to keep her family together. She was the spiritual rock. She was a prayer warrior. So when my mom died, it left this very deep, profound emotional spiritual void with my mom's passing. And that culminates with the Atlanta shooting. The Atlanta shooting, as you may recall, it was devastating for so many of us in the Asian American community. And it was a double whammy. And I can sort of understand now when victims of sexual violence are being re-victimized by the question by, you know, by the prosecutor, it's a defense attorney, whatever. That's what it felt like, because this was clear to all of us in the Asian American community. This is a hate crime.
Yes.
And then to hear, oh no, this was not a hate crime. This was a sex crime. This 20-year-old had a sex addict, and he's a good Christian kid who went to a Baptist church. You know, and he had a bad day. Y'all remember that? That was the police officer. He had a bad day. He was a sex addict. You know, they dismissed one of the eyewitness accounts. They said, "I'm here to kill Asians." Mm-hmm. They dismissed that. Because it was reported in a Korean newspaper and not, you know, in a, well, this is a Korean community. We don't talk to outsiders. Mm. So that's why we knew in our community that this was going on. The crushing part was when they listed the names in Korean names of the victims. And as you may recall, they were older Korean women. They were 73 years old, 69 years old, 63 years old, and I think 52 years old. These were not sex workers. You know, the 73-year-old woman working at the spa, and this is the other thing, though. Oh, these spas were massage parlors. There were, you know, places where sex trade was going on. These 73-year-old, 69-year-old, 63-year-old women were not sex workers. They were service workers. They were picking up the towels and cleaning the bathrooms and, you know, working the cash register. These were not sex workers who were asking for it, as the narrative started getting, oh, they were sex workers, they were asking for it. And when I saw the Korean names, I, you know, it really hit home, because my mom never worked at a spa, but she worked at service industry jobs.
Yeah.
She was the invisible older Korean woman who cooked the food, cleaned up. She worked at a nursing home where she changed the bedpans. She did the service industry job that so many immigrant families do and are oftentimes invisible. And they were trying to wipe their stories out, calling them sex workers, or, oh, they were working at a massage parlor. No, they were immigrant moms and grandmothers who were working whatever job they could to keep their family together, just like my mom did. And those kinds of social narratives is devastating for those of us who are walking through that. So I'm beginning to recover from what has been a, you might want to bleep this out, you know, begins with S, ends with itty. You know, it's been that kind of year. It's been that kind of year. But, you know, lament has actually been that space. Lament alongside, I think when the AAPI community gathered together to lament over the dead bodies in our community, especially the older Asian women. My family, you know, despite COVID, we said, you know what, this is, it doesn't matter. And we probably shouldn't have done this, but, you know, the entire extended family, my sisters, their kids, we actually were able to gather together for the last week as my mom passed and surround her and lament together and rejoice alongside and tell stories and, you know, kind of be there together. Those are the places where lament is healing. Our community lament together when Big Fella died and Rusty died, these two students of ours at Stateville. Communal lament is powerful. And I don't know where I would have gone and survived if there hadn't been these places of communal lament.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm just so sorry, just so much pain last year, personally, nationally. And I just, I really appreciate you sharing that. And it just seems as you're sharing that, like, it just, in times of suffering, there's just so much hopelessness and powerlessness, and you don't see the light. And it just, I just feel like what you're saying is lament is the thing to do. It doesn't take you out of it. It doesn't fast track it, but I think it gives almost the only purpose that could exist within the time of suffering. And it's the only, it's an appropriate response. And so I just appreciate you sharing that. I feel like even again, like I remember you talking about your mom the first time I heard you speak four or five years ago. Yeah. And I have told that story about your mom and how she's such a faithful woman of prayer. That's right. And like I was so impacted by you from on stage and I was transformed by that. And so I just appreciate you sharing not just your story right now towards the end, but just everything you shared and given in our listeners so much to consider and think about, reflect on in our own lives. I love what you just said, communal lament. Again, it moves away from this individualistic exceptionalism and move towards community, which God created us for. So thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you. Soon Chan, thank you so much. As you get ready to head out, how can our listeners follow your work? What do you got coming up?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. So you can always look for me at Prof Rod, and I think both of those spaces. I'm terrible on Instagram. I only started an account to follow my kids, and I'm just awful at it. So Twitter and Facebook is probably better. I'm doing an event on May 22nd. I think this drops right around that time, so it might be just in time to go ahead and register. We're doing an event with Art Alive, where if you look up Art Alive and Prof Ra, you should be able to find it. On May 22nd, we're doing kind of an online event to kind of do some discussion and conversation around issues of lament and the changing face of American Christianity. I am also doing an online coaching group. You can look up Tailored Coached, T-A-I-L-O-R-E-D, Tailored Coach, and my name. And it's a small group. It allows me to have this personal interaction with a smaller group of leaders to kind of coach them through issues around multi-ethnicity and cross-cultural ministry. So you can check that out. I'll be starting a cohort probably in the fall. Awesome. But the big news is that I am leaving North Park after 15 years. It's very heartbreaking. Wow. But I'm starting a new job at Fuller Theological Seminary this summer. So
all
looking
right.
forward to that move as well.
All the snaps right there. Yes, yes. Amazing. Well, Soon Chan, again, thank you so much for the time. Thanks for hanging out with Matthew and I. I really appreciate it. Y'all, this was part two of our second series, In the Valley. Part three will be on joy and rest in the valley. So as we close out the Roll Down podcast as part of the Chasing Justice Podcast Network, to find out more, visit chasingjustice.com. Please rate and review us on Spotify and Apple and share with your friends. You can find us on Instagram at The Roll Down Podcast. Want to shout out and give thanks to our team as always, Caleb, our producer, Jaslyn, social media marketing, Cam, our graphic designer, and Alex, the Roll Down assistant. And as always, y'all, thanks for listening to The Roll Down.
Thanks, y'all.